practice, again sitting on a chair from some long-ago yard sale in front of a tape recorder mic, back in a neglected cubicle among brooms, mops, cleaning supplies, and an antique floor waxing machine, which may have been assembled from World War II tank parts, he'd begun to wonder if the affectionate Penny of last night hadn't just been another wishful hallucination. She kept calling him Larry, for one thing, and avoiding eye contact. The witness she brought along naturally turned out to be her cubicle mate, Roos, whose glare had intensified overnight from suspicion to loathing. Doc ran through for them what he'd seen in Vegas, having stopped by his office earlier to pick up a logbook, a sign not so much of professionalism as of doper's memory. There was uncommon interest in Mickey's white suit, for some reason. Lapel notch location and so forth. Ready-made or bespoke. And how was his attitude, they wanted to know. Who was present, besides the FBI? Who appeared to be in charge? No way to tell. There was casino security and all kinds of civilians in suits moving around, but in terms of mob folks, if that's what you're getting at, were they wearing black fedoras, making with Eddie Robinson remarks? No, not that I know of. This county DA exercise really looked to Doc like pissants versus elephants. You could catch the FBI in the act of sodomizing the president in the Lincoln Memorial at high noon, and local law enforcement would still just have to stand around and watch, getting more or less nauseated depending which president. On the other hand, nobody asked about Puck Beaverton, and Doc didn't volunteer anything. Now and then he caught the two deputy DAs giving each other significant looks. What about, he had no idea. Finally, the tape ran out, and Penny said, "I think we're done here. On behalf of the DA's office, Mr. Sportello, thank you so much for your cooperation." "And thank you, Miss Kimball, for not thanking me while the tape was on. And Miss Frothingham, may I add, that skirt length on you today is especially attractive." Roos screamed and picked up a galvanized trash can prepared to throw it at Doc's head, but Penny intervened and coaxed her out the door. Just before she disappeared herself, she looked back at Doc and pointed at the phone, making phone call gestures. Who was supposed to call whom was less clear. The clock up on the wall, which reminded Doc of elementary school back in the San Joaquin, read some hour that it could not possibly be. Doc waited for the hands to move, but they didn't, from which he deduced that the clock was broken, and maybe had been for years. Which was groovy, however, because long ago Sortilege had taught him the esoteric skills of telling time from a broken clock. The first thing you had to do was light a joint, which in the Hall of Justice might seem odd, but surely not way back here. Who knew? Maybe even outside the jurisdiction of local drug enforcement. Though just to be on the safe side, he also lit a De Nobili cigar and filled the room with a precautionary cloud of smoke from the classic mafia favorite. After inhaling pot smoke for a while, he glanced up at the clock, and sure enough, it showed a different time now, though this could also be from Doc having forgotten where the hands were to begin with. The phone rang. He picked up and heard Penny say, "Come down to my cubicle. There'll be a package waiting for you." No hello or nothing. "Will you be there?" "No." "How about, what's her name?"
"Nobody'll be there but you. Take all the time you need."
"Thanks, babe. Oh, hey, and by the way, I was wondering if I could find you a Manson chick-type wig to wear. Would it be like a problem?" The change in sound ambience as she hung up echoed for a while. "I was thinking in terms of Lynette Squeaky Fromey, you know, sort of long and curled at the same time and..." Oh, Penny? Downstairs in Penny's cubicle, waiting for Doc on a beat-up old wood table and decorated with all kinds of top-secret stickers, sat the record of Adrian Prush's strange history with the California Public Code, including his numerous escapes from punishment for Murder One. Doc lit a cool, opened the folder, and started reading. And it was clear right away why the department didn't want any of this known. His first thought was how much danger Penny might have put herself in the way of for unsealing this, maybe not even aware of how much. For her, it was just more ancient history. Detective X's name turned out to be Vincent Indelicato. Adrian's lawyers had argued justifiable homicide. Their client, Mr. Prussia, a widely respected businessman, believed someone was breaking into his beach apartment on Gummo Mark's Way, had mistaken the decedent for the irate husband of a female acquaintance, and, swearing further that he'd seen a gun, thereupon fired his own. No one was more upset than Mr. Prussia to find he'd plugged an LAPD detective, one he had even in fact met occasionally in the course of his normal day's business. The body was identified by the arresting officer, Detective Indelicato's partner of many years, Lieutenant Christian F. Bjornson. What? Doc wondered aloud. The fuck is going on here? Bigfoot's partner, the one he didn't ride with these days, or talk about, or even mention by name. Bigfoot's air of possessed melancholy now began to make sense. This was mourning, all right, and it was deep. And where else could the events have taken place but Gummo Mark's Way? GMW, as it was known locally, the hard luck boulevard everybody living along Doc's piece of shoreline sooner or later ended up on, though nobody Doc knew had ever lived there, or knew anybody else who did. Yet somehow there it always lay between the populations of the South Bay beach towns and other places they thought at some point in their lives they needed to be. The home of a girlfriend whose psychopathic parents wanted her back before curfew. A dealer shifty as a rat up a palm tree, whose less wary clients found themselves putting oregano and Bisquick to uses they were never meant for. A payphone in a bar that a friend of a friend, in peril and without resources, had called you from, the hope in his voice already fading, too late at night. Now, wait a minute, Doc muttered, maybe out loud. Is what this is now is... Bigfoot's partner is murdered by Adrian Prussia, with the apparent collaboration of elements in the department. How does Bigfoot react? Does he check out an appropriate-sized cannon and some extra clips and go looking for Adrian? Does he plant a bomb in the loan shark's car? Does he keep it all inside the LAPD and embark on a nonviolent and lonely crusade for justice? No, none of the above. Instead, what Bigfoot does is he finds some dumb-ass sucker of a civilian PI who'll keep nosing on into the case, maybe even clumsily enough to call some attention. And then what? What did Bigfoot expect to happen? Somebody would decide to come after Doc? Groovy. And where'd be the nameless, unspoken-of partner to watch Doc's back for him? As if looking for something he knew he didn't want to find, Doc leafed quickly through the other arrest in the folder. It became clear as vodka you keep in the icebox that whatever the connection was between the LAPD and Adrian Prussia, he might as well have been working for them as a contract killer. Time after time he was pulled in, questioned, arraigned, indicted. No matter, somehow the cases never quite got to trial, each being bargained down in the interests of justice, not to mention of Adrian, who invariably walked. The thought did flit on fragile moth-like wings in and out of Doc's consciousness that the DA's office had to be aware of all this, if not outright complicit. Sometimes there wouldn't be enough evidence for a case, or what there was would be inadmissible or too circumstantial or the body couldn't be found. Or sometimes a third party would come forward and plead to some make-believe offense like voluntary manslaughter. One of these thoughtful patsies in particular caught Doc's attention, turning out to be who but his old parking lot Q&A buddy, Boris Spivey, currently on the run out in the U.S. someplace with his fiancée Donette. From Pico Rivera. Curiously, after pulling reduced time on the semi-honor block at San Quentin, Boris had then been cut loose to go directly to work for Mickey Wolfman, making him, along with Puck, the second AP Finance alumnus Doc knew of, who'd hired on with Mickey. Was Adrian Prussia also running a talent agency? Doc was about to shut the folder and go looking for a cigarette machine when something more recent caught his eye. It was a brightly lit photograph, which didn't look attached to anything else, as if it had been tossed in some miscellaneous way. It showed a group of men standing on a pier next to an open box about the size of a coffin, full of U.S. currency. Among them was Adrian Prussia, in some idea of a yachting costume, holding up one of the bills and making with the shit-eating grin which had endeared him to so many. The bill was a 20 and looked strangely familiar. Doc rooted around in his fringe bag till he found a Coddington lens and squinted through it at the picture. Aha! Just as he thought. It was that CIA Nixon had funny money again, like the Bill Sancho and his pals had fished out of the drink. And in the background, riding calmly at anchor in some nameless harbor, slightly out of focus, as if through the veils of the next world, the schooner Golden Fang. There was a date on the back of the photo. Less than a year ago. On the way back to the beach, Doc looked in at the offices of Hardy, Gridley, and Chatfield. Sancho was there, but mentally, for the moment, not available, having the other night happened to watch The Wizard of Oz, 1939, for the first time on a color TV set.
"Did you know it starts off in black and white?" he informed Doc with some anxiety. "But it changes to color? Do you realize what that means?"
"Sanch, no use.
The world we see Dorothy living in at the beginning of the picture is black. Actually brown and white, only she thinks she's seeing it all in color. The same normal everyday color we see our lives in. Then the cyclone picks her up, dumps her in Munchkin Land, and she walks out the door, and suddenly we see the brown and white shift into Technicolor. But if that's what we see, what's happening with Dorothy? What's her normal Kansas color changing into, huh? What very weird hypercolor? As far beyond our everyday color as Technicolor is beyond black and white?" And so on.
"I know I should be worried about this, Sanch, but the network ought to at least run a disclaimer."
Sancho, by now quite indignant. "Munchkin Land is strange enough, isn't it? Without adding to the viewer's mental confusion? And in fact, I think there's a pretty good class action suit here against MGM itself, so I'm going to bring it up at the firm's next weekly get-together."
"Well, can I ask you something that's sort of related?"
"You mean about Dorothy and the..."
"Sort of. You recall that stash of Nixon bills you guys hauled out of the drink? I just ran across a photo of a loan shark named Adrian Prussia posed next to a box full of this stuff. Maybe from the same batch you found, maybe not. Did anybody keep a record of what happened to it after you hauled it in?"
"I'd certainly like to think most of it's safe and sound in a federal evidence room someplace."
"You'd like to, but..."
"Well, for a while out on the deck there, it all got into a happy-go-lucky type atmosphere. Federals are like everybody else. You can't expect them to live on their salaries."
"Thing about this picture is,
is they all look like they just got off, or were maybe about to get on, the Golden Fang.
Swell. So how does this relate again to Dorothy Gale and her color vision situation?
What?
You said this photo you saw was sort of related?
Oh. Oh, well, it was in this strange color process. Yeah, colors looked like they do on acid.
Nice try, Doc.
Figuring to check in at his office, Doc left the marina by way of Lincoln Boulevard, slid across the creek and down Culver to Vista Del Mar. Even in the parking lot, he felt something was strange, not only in the afternoon hush of the building, but also in Petunia's demeanor.
Oh, Doc, do you really have to go upstairs right away? It's been ages since we had one of our interesting chats.
She was perched attractively on a sort of high bar stool next to her check-in station, and Doc couldn't help noticing that her lilac turnout today didn't seem to include matching or, in fact, any underwear. Good thing he was wearing shades, which allowed him to gaze for longer than usual.
Petunia, are you trying to tell me I have visitors waiting?
She lowered her gaze and voice.
Not exactly.
Not exactly visitors?
Not exactly waiting.
The door upstairs was unlocked and slightly ajar. Doc stooped and reached the little snub-nosed Magnum out of his ankle rig, though it did not take a sharp ear to identify what was going on inside. He eased through the door, and the first thing he saw was Clancy Sharlock and Tariq Khalil down on his office floor, fucking. After a while, Tariq looked up.
Hey, Dr. Sportello, my man. This is all right, isn't it?
Doc raised his sunglasses and pretended to scrutinize the scene.
Looks all right to me, but you'd know better than I would.
What he means is,
Clancy from somewhere underneath clarified,
is it all right that we're using your office?
Seems while Doc was in Vegas, they had showed up here separately one day looking for him, and Petunia decided they were a cute couple, so she gave them a spare key. Doc excused himself and headed back downstairs to have a word with Petunia, the particular word on his mind being cute.
I know you have the soul of a matchmaker, Petunia, and normally I'm groovy with intimacy of all kinds, but not between elements in a case I'm working on. Too much information I end up never seeing.
And so on. Fat lot of good this did, against the perhaps insane sparkle in her eyes.
But it's too late, can't you see? They're in love. I'm just the karmic facilitator. I really have the gift for knowing who's supposed to be together and who's not, and I'm never wrong. I've even been staying up late, night after night, studying for my degree in relationship counseling, so I can make some contribution, no matter how tiny, to the total amount of love in the world.
The total what?
Oh, Doc, love is the only thing that will ever save us.
Who?
Everybody.
Petunia!
Screamed Dr. Tubeside from some back region of the suite.
Well, maybe not him.
I think I'm gonna go back upstairs now and see if they're really there.
After a couple of careful taps on his office door, Doc put his head gingerly around the edge of it, this time observed Tariq and Clancy with their clothes back on, playing a quiet game of gin rummy, and listening to a Bonzo Dog Band album, which to his knowledge, Doc didn't own. Obviously hallucination wasn't out of the question here, but then again, if it really was happening, all the average pothead had to do was look at them to see that their common element, Glenn Sharlock, had been gathering presence and energy, like a ghost slowly becoming visible.
Clancy noticed Doc and whispered something to Tariq. They put down their cards, and Tariq said,
"Figured on you showing up sometime, man."
Doc headed for the electric coffee pot and started in making coffee.
"I had to go to Las Vegas," he said. "I thought I was looking for Puck Beaverton."
Clancy mentioned something. Any luck?
"Nothing but," Doc shrugged. "It was Vegas."
"He's pissed off," Clancy said.
"Am not."
"I wanted to talk to you about Glenn," Tariq said.
"So did I,"
added Clancy. Doc nodded, looked in his shirt for a cigarette, came up empty-fingered.
"Here," said Clancy.
"Virginia Slims? What is this?"
But Clancy was holding out her lighter like the Statue of Liberty or something.
"All right," Doc said. "It's menthol, at least."
"I should have told you the whole thing," Tariq said. "Too late now, but I still could have trusted you more."
"Some white detective you never met before and you didn't trust me? Wow, now I am pissed off."
"You need to tell him," Clancy pointed out to Tariq.
"But..." Doc went to supervise the coffee maker. "Wait a minute, man. Didn't you say you had to take some oath of silence about that?"
"That don't count," Tariq said. "I thought it did once, but Puck and them other Nazis took an oath, too, to watch each other's back no matter what. And look how much good it did Glenn. Am I, supposed to respect that shit? I'm off the hook now. They don't like it. They can see how far they get with it."
"Okay. So, what was it Glenn owed you, exactly?"
"First, you gotta take an oath."
"What? You just said that was bullshit."
"Yeah, but you a honky. You got to sign off in blood. Blood that you won't ever tell nobody."
"Blood?"
"Clancy did."
"I'm in the middle of my period, darling," she pointed out.
"So, could I borrow some of yours?" Doc wondered.
"Hey, fuck this."
Tariq heading for the door. "Emotional, ain't he?" Doc going over to the file cabinet and retrieving his emergency stash. Like if this wasn't an emergency. Around the second or possibly third joint, everybody began to relax. Tariq got into the business he and Glenn had done together while inside. It was complicated. The original beef was between two Chicano factions, Nuestra Familia, who were based out of Northern California, and the Sureños, who were from down south here. At that moment among the prison population, there had been active a snitch known as El Huevoncito, who had brought grief to many inmates, black and white, as well as Chicano. Everybody hated this little rat. Everybody knew he'd have to be dealt with. But for reasons of gang history, which grew very tangled, especially when you were smoking weed, none of the Chicano population, north or south, could conveniently do the deed. So they finally subbed it out to the Aryan brothers, who just then also happened to have an opening for a new member, and were trying to recruit Glenn Sherlock for the slot. Part of the initiation being that you had to kill somebody. Sometimes giving them a cut on the face was enough, but then that meant they'd eventually have to come after you looking for payback. So it was better, Tariq explained, to just kill they ass and get it over with. Glenn wanted to be in the Brotherhood, but didn't want to kill anybody. He knew he would fuck up somehow and get caught, because somehow he always did. And if he wasn't killed on the spot by associates of El Huevoncito, he'd either get a trip upstate to the San Quentin Green Room or be kept in the joint forever, when all he really wanted, sometimes desperately, was to be outside. On the other hand, the brothers were being really pains in the ass about it. So Glenn went looking for a way to subcontract the hit, take credit for it among the brothers, but escape retaliation from anybody else. Tariq enjoyed a reputation as a shank artist who never got caught, but approaching him
took almost more caution than Glenn knew how to use. Black and white did not routinely mix, nor were they encouraged to.
"Sound like fun," Tariq admitted, "but it'll cost a lot. Unless I'm mistaken, more than you've got, or be likely to have."
True, as far as it went, except that Glenn had some unusual connections on the outside, though he'd been careful not to share this information unless he had to. Now, it looked like he had to.
"How would you be wanting payment? In cash, dope, pussy?" Tariq just stared back.
"Help me out. Watermelons?" Tariq thought about taking offense, shrugged, and made a minimal gesture with his trigger finger to indicate firearms.
"What do you know? My friends just happened to specialize in that area. What kind of weight we be talking about?" "Oh, enough for somewhere between a platoon of niggas and a company."
Glenn looked around for eavesdroppers. "You don't mean for in here, man?"
"Shit, no. I'm bad, not stupid. But we all got friends outside. And mine, that's what they could use right now."
"How soon?"
"How soon you want them wood sucking all on your dick in gratitude?"
A blur, a shadow passed, and neither Tariq nor Glenn was sure what they saw, but they knew who it was.
"Some rat running for his hole," Glenn said. "Means we've been walking and talking too long. Better from here on, we keep it short."
By and by, El Huevoncito, rest his soul, was found mysteriously deceased after an early morning shake and bake on Tariq's block, which gave Tariq a perfect alibi and never got traced to him. Glenn, with his time also accounted for, was likewise in the clear, though he made a point of asking for brotherly assistance in disposing of a mess hall shank he'd first put some of his own blood on. He was accepted into the Aryan Brotherhood, and shortly after Tariq's release, found himself also on the outside, with a job offer from Mickey Wolfman. As it turned out, because of the logistics, Tariq's people, Warriors Against the Man, Black Armed Militia, or Wham Bam, had to wait a while for Glenn to set up the small arms part of the deal, and by now were growing fretful.
"Which is about the time I come to see you," Tariq said.
"I can dig why you didn't want to get too specific," Doc said. "Maybe I should have took that oath."
"I understand you've been getting some shit from the local FBI, Brother Karenga's bed buddies."
"Yeah, but I couldn't tell them much because I didn't know all this. Now I guess I'll have to start worrying about the Red Squad and the P. Diddy's, too."
"How's that?"
"See, technically it's Black Armed Rebellion, ain't it? Gets us into heavy Charles Manson fantasy material. And there's idiots enough in the LAPD who take old Charlie seriously when he starts in screaming about all that."
"Yeah. Over at the Wham Bam office, too. I've been seeing these T-shirts and shit. Like Manson's mugshots with afros airbrushed onto them. That's real popular."
"How about Lynette Squeaky Fromey?"
"Yeah, ain't she some righteous-ass bitch?"
"No, I meant, like, Squeaky T-shirts, where she has an afro."
"Oh, not that I know of. You want me to look around for one?"
"Actually, maybe Leslie Van Houten, too. What do you think?"
"Fellas,"
muttered Clancy.
"Right," Doc said. "Then I guess what I really need to know from you is who these friends of Glenn's were that were arranging this arms deal."
"Some bunch of honky dentists out on Lower Sunset. Worked out of some weird-ass building. Looked like a big tooth."
"Uh-huh." Doc trying not to betray the hollowness of soul that hit him now. "Well, maybe I can think of one or two places to look." Questions arose, like, what in the fuck was going on here, basically? If Glenn all along had had friends in the Golden Fang,
What was he even doing in the pen? Was he taking the fall for somebody else? Some higher-level figure in the Fang organization? Had they put him in there as a deliberate plant, the Fang's man on the inside, as if they had a master scheme to station their agents in all areas of public life? And how deeply implicated did that make the Fang in Glenn's murder? Was Glenn another Rudy Blatnoid? Had he touched some acupressure point forever uncharted on the mysterious body of the Golden Fang so uncomfortably he had to be dealt with? And would this be multiple choice? By now it was dark, and they were all hungry, and somehow they ended up at the plastic nickel on Sepulveda. Inside, the walls were decorated with silvery plastic reproductions of the head side of a U.S. 5-cent coin, each about the size of a giant pizza. An artificial hedge about 2 feet high, very green, and also of plastic, separated the rows of booths. Crews of unknown hedge assembly specialists had carefully fitted together thousands of small modular leafy twig imitations, plug and jackwise, in nearly infinite complexity, to produce this strangely entertaining shrubbery. Over time, all manner of small articles got lost down inside of it, including roach clips and roaches and hash pipes, loose change, car keys, earrings, contact lenses, tiny glassine packets of coke and heroin and so forth. Life below, say, 1 gram. Customers had been known to spend hours while their coffee got cold, carefully going through the hedge inch by inch, especially when on speed. Now and then, late at night, they would be interrupted by one of the plastic images up on the wall, as Thomas Jefferson turned from left profile to full face, unfastened the ribbon that held his hair back, shook everything out into a full-color red-headed freak halo, and spoke to selected dopers, usually quoting from the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights, which had actually been of great help with many legal defenses, focusing on search and seizure issues in particular. Tonight he waited till Clancy and Tariq had both headed back to the toilets, turned quickly to Doc, and said,
"So, the Golden Fang not only traffic in enslavement, they peddle the implements of liberation as well."
"Hey, but as a founding father, don't you get freaked out a little with this black apocalypse talk?"
"The Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants," replied Jefferson. "It is its natural manure."
"Yeah, and what about when the patriots and tyrants turn out to be the same people?" said Doc. "Like, we've got this president now."
"As long as they bleed," explained Jefferson, "is the thing. Meantime, what are you going to do with the information you've just acquired from Mr. Khalil?"
"Let's see, what are the choices? Go to the FBI and rat out Tariq, and wham-bam? Sick the feds onto the Golden Fang after giving Tariq enough warning to keep his own ass clear? Tell Bigfoot Bjornsson everything and let him present it to the P-Did or whoever? And let them deal with it? What am I leaving out?"
"Do you begin to detect a common thread here, Lawrence?"
"I can't trust any of those people?"
"Remember, too, that Glenn's weapons deal never went through, so you don't really have to tell anybody anything. What you do have to do, however, is..."
He fell abruptly silent and turned back into his ponytailed profile.
"Talking to yourself again?" said Clancy.
"You need to find true love, Doc."
Actually, he thought, I'll settle for finding my way through this. His fingers, with a mind of their own, began to creep toward the plastic hedge. Maybe if he searched through it long enough, late enough into the night, he'd find something that might help. Some tiny forgotten scrap of his life he didn't even know was missing. Something that would make all the difference now. He said, "I'm happy for you, Clancy, but what happened to that two at a time?"
She gestured with her head back at Tariq, on his way to rejoin them.
Doc, this guy is at least two at a time.
Chapter 17. Back at his place, Doc found Scott and Dinas in the kitchen investigating the icebox, having just climbed in the alley window after Dinas, a bit earlier, down at his own place, had fallen asleep as he often did with a lit joint in his mouth. Only this time the joint, instead of dropping onto his chest and burning him and waking him up at least part way, had rolled someplace else among the bedsheets, where it soon began to smolder. After a while, Dinas woke, got up, and wandered into the bathroom. Thought he would take a shower. Sort of got into doing that. At some point, the bed burst into flame, burning eventually up through the ceiling, directly above which was his neighbor, Chico's waterbed. Luckily for Chico, without him on it, which being plastic melted from the heat, releasing nearly a ton of water through the hole that had by now burned in the ceiling, putting out the fire in Dinas's bedroom while turning the floor into a sort of wading pool. Dinas came drifting back from the bathroom, and not able right away to account for what he found, plus getting the fire department, who had now arrived, confused with the police, went running down the alley to Scott Oof's beach place, where he tried to describe what he thought had happened, basically deliberate sabotage by the boards, who had never stopped plotting against him. Doc found a White Owl cigar, most of whose contents he had tweezed out, and replaced with Humboldt Sinsamilla, lit up, inhaled, and started passing it around.
"I don't see how it could be the boards, man, really," exhaled Scott. "Hey, I saw them," Dinas insisted, "just the other day lurking in the alley."
"That was only the bass player and drummer," Scott said. "We were hanging out. There's going to be a free concert at Will Rogers Park. They're calling it a Surfadelic Freak-In, and the boards want beer to open for them."
"Groovy," said Doc. "Congratulations." "Yeah," added Dinas, "except they're totally evil, of course."
"Well, maybe the label they're signed with," Scott admitted.
"But even Doc thinks they're zombies."
"That's probably true," Doc said. "But you can't always blame zombies for their condition. Ain't like there's guidance counselors going around. Hey, kid, you ever consider career opportunities with the undead?"
"Mine told me I should go into real estate," said Scott. "Like my mom." "Your mom's not a zombie," Dinas pointed out.
"Yeah, but you should see some of her co-brokers."
"Just so's you examine her regularly for bites," Doc advised, "which is how it gets transmitted."
"Anybody understand why they call it real estate?" wondered Dinas, who was now rolling a joint.
"Hey, Doc," Scott remembered, "I saw that koi again. They used to play with the boards. Who was supposed to be dead, only later he wasn't?"
Doc was just barely not too loaded to ask, "Where?"
"In Hermosa, standing in line outside the lighthouse."
Sending Doc off down the toilet of memory to when he and Shasta were first dating. Evenings hanging out in front of the lighthouse cafe, neither of them able to afford the prices, listening to the jazz from inside, and eating hot dogs from the renowned Juicy James stand around the corner, whose sign featured a giant hot dog with a face, arms, and legs, cowboy hat, and getup, firing a pair of six guns, and to all appearances, enjoying itself. On Sundays, there was always a jam session. Studio musicians showed up in rides they had bought with their first big paychecks, to be redeemed in years to follow from impound lots, winched out of mudslides, preserved from the depredations of divorce lawyers, all replacement parts kept authentic for resales that would never happen, fantasies of the eras when the longings began. Morgans from the showroom up in Westwood with hoods held down by leather straps,
Cobra 289s, and 62 Bonnevilles, and that supernatural DeSoto in which James Stewart, gone round the bend of love, tails Kim Novak in Vertigo, 1958. Up at Ojai, Doc and Coy had parted under strange circumstances, with Coy doing an abrupt fade into the evening, half angry, half desperate, after Doc's sort of half-promise that he'd look for some way for Coy to cut loose of the counter-subversives who were running him. Except for the quick once-over Bigfoot let him have at Coy's LAPD file, Doc hadn't made much progress with this, and he may have been feeling guilty, because technically he was supposed to be working for Hope, too. So he thought he'd take a stroll down to Pier Avenue. The palm trees along the Strand cast shadows through the fog with its usual chemical smell. The Juicy James sign glowed cheerfully, smudged at some uncertain distance. And there, in front of the lighthouse, sure enough, was Coy, among a ragged line of hipsters nodding to the music. Bud Shank today, and some rhythm section. Doc waited for a break between sets and said howdy, expecting another Invisible Man number. But right now, Coy had the look of a sailor on liberty, willing to live inside the moment till he had to be back in some condition of servitude.
I got to take the day off.
He checked the light over the ocean.
But it looks like maybe I'm about to be AWOL.
You need a ride up to Topanga? Long as I don't have to come in with you, that is.
Oh, that all got fixed. Now everything's cool.
Drax a part of the band?
Seriously, it was the chicks. None of them could handle it anymore. So they all got together and kicked in and hired an exorcist. Some Buddhist priest from the temple downtown. He came up one day and did his thing, and now the boards and the house are all officially dezombified. They gave him a maintenance contract to run regular psychic perimeter checks.
Did any of the band, like, suddenly recognize you?
He shrugged. Maybe. It don't matter as much as it used to.
The fog had thickened by the time they reached the car. Doc and Coy got in, and Doc put the wipers on for a couple of cycles, and they headed up Pier Avenue.
Chisel one of your smokes? Coy said.
Doc reached him the pack off the dashboard and pushed in the lighter and took a left on Pacific Coast Highway.
Hey, what's this button here?
Maybe not. That's the... They were submerged in the bone-shaking reverberations of Pink Floyd's Interstellar Overdrive. Doc found the volume knob. The vibrasonic takes up half the trunk, but it's there when you need it. Going under the runway to the airport, they lost the music for a minute, and Doc said, "So the boards really aren't so evil anymore?"
"Maybe confused now and then. You know a band that isn't?"
You back playing with them now?
Working on it.
Doc knew there was more coming.
See, I always needed to think somebody gave a shit. When the call came from Vigilant California, it was like somebody's been watching all the time. Somebody who wants me. Sees something in me I never guessed was there.
A gift, they told him, for projecting alternate personalities. Infiltrating, remembering, reporting back.
A spy, Coy translated. A snitch, a weasel.
A very well-paid actor, they replied, and without groupies or paparazzi or know-nothing audiences to worry about. It would mean kicking heroin, or at least the kind of habit he had then. They told him stories about junkies who had gained control of their addictions. It was called the higher discipline, more demanding than religious or athletic or military discipline, because of the abyss you had to dare successfully every moment of every day. They took Coy to meet some of these transcended junkies, and he was amazed at their energy, their color, their bounce in their stride,
the improvisational quickness of mind. If Coy performed up to spec or beyond, there would also be the bonus incentive of a once-a-year fix of Percodan, then regarded as the Rolls-Royce of opiates. Of course, it would mean leaving Hope and Amethyst for good. But nobody at home, he kept reminding himself, had been happy for a real long time. And the Vigis promised to send Hope an anonymous one-time payment, suggesting strongly that it was from Coy. It would have to look like something he'd left them in a will, however, because in order to carry out this particular job, he must assume one or more new identities, and the old identity of Coy Harlingen must cease to be.
Fake my death? Oh, I don't know, man. I mean, that's really bad karma. Don't know if I want to do what little Anthony and the Imperials call tempt the hand of fate, you know?
Why think of this as death? Why not reincarnation instead? Everybody wishes they had a different life. Here's your opportunity. Plus you get to have fun, to take chances with your ass, unparalleled even in the world of heroin abuse. And the pay is far, far better than scale, assuming you ever worked for scale.
Can I get some new choppers?
False teeth? That could be arranged.
The fix was also in, they assured him, with Coy's dealer, El Drano, to provide some especially lethal, unstepped-on China White to be found at the scene of the overdose. Coy was advised to use only enough to be plausible in the emergency room, but not enough to kill him.
Not my favorite part of the caper, Coy confessed to Doc. It was like, I better not fuck up this time. I better have my wits about me, and of course I didn't. As it was, I nearly ate the big wiener anyway.
Where'd your dealer get this heroin from? Doc asked as pretty much a formality.
Some bunch of heavies who bring it in direct. Not the connection El Drano usually dealt with. Whoever they were, they had him scared shitless. Even though he was just the cutout guy, in there to keep it from being traced back to this other source. But they kept telling him, never say a word. Silence, that was their big thing. So when he showed up floating in the canal the other day, you know, naturally I couldn't help but wonder.
Could have been anything, though, Doc said. He had a long history.
Maybe.
Eventually, like other turned souls before him, Coy put in some discomfort time at the Chryskylodon program kicking heroin, from which visit to the smile maintenance workshop of Rudy Blatnoid DDS seemed almost like vacations. The new teeth meant a new embouchure, and that also took some adjusting. But finally, one night there he was in a toilet stall at LAX, passing compromising notes on toilet paper under the partition to a state legislator with hidden sexual longings, whom the Vigis wished to have, as they put it, on the team. After this, he guessed, audition, the assignments gradually got more demanding. Preparation sometimes included reading Herbert Marcuse and Chairman Mao, and the comprehension issues that came along with that, plus daily workouts at a dojo in Whittier, dialect coaching in Outer Hollywood, evasive driving lessons out in Chatsworth. It didn't take long for Coy to become aware that the Patriots who were running him were being run themselves by another level of power altogether, which seemed to feel entitled to fuck with the lives of all who weren't as good or bright as they were, which meant everybody. Coy learned they'd labeled him an addictive personality, betting that once committed to snitching for his country, he would find the life as hard to kick as heroin, if not harder. Pretty soon they had him hanging around campuses, university, community college, and high school, and slowly learning to infiltrate anti-war, anti-draft, anti-capitalist groups of all kinds. For the first months, he was so busy he didn't have time to think about what he'd actually done, or if there was any future in it.
One night he was in Westwood shadowing elements of a group at UCLA called the Bong Users Revolutionary Brigades, or BURBS, when he noticed a little girl, who would have been about Amethyst's age, breathless with excitement in front of a lighted bookstore window, calling to her mother to come and look. "Books! Mama! Books!" Coy stood nailed in his tracks, while his quarry went on with their evening. It was the first time since signing on with the Vigies that he'd given any thought to the family he had abandoned for something he must have believed was more important. In that moment, everything was clear. The karmic era of faking his own death, the chances that people he was helping to set up were looking at deep possibilities, including real death, and clearest of all, how much he missed hope and Amethyst, more, desperately more, than he'd ever thought he would. With no resources, sympathy, or support, Coy, all of a sudden, too late, wanted his old life back.
"And that's around the time you asked me to look in on them?"
"Yep, that's how desperate I was."
"This is it here, right?"
Doc pulled over on the shoulder near the apron of the board's driveway.
"One thing."
"Uh-oh."
"The original job offer from Vigilant California? Who was it that called you?"
Coy looked Doc over, as if for the first time.
"When I started spying, I used to wonder why people ask the questions they do. Then I began to notice how often they already know the answer, but they just want to hear it from another voice, like outside their own head."
"All right,"
Doc said.
"Better go talk to Shasta Fay, I think."
Driving back down to the coast road, Doc managed to put himself on a full-scale paranoid trip about Shasta and how she must have been using all the time she and Doc were together. Maybe, since before they'd met, a devoted junkie taking every chance she could to slip out into the fine, breezy nights and go someplace they'd have been looking after her outfit for her, so she wouldn't have to hide it at home from Doc, just to be back for a while among the junkie fellowship, to have a break from this hopeless stooge of the creditor class she was already planning to split on and so forth. It took him nearly all the way to Gordita to remember that once again he was being an asshole. By the time he got back to his place and reconfigured his hair into something halfway groovy and set off up the Esplanade to El Porto with night fallen and the surf invisible, he was back to his old, wised-up self, short on optimism, ready to be played for a patsy again. Normal. The surf shop downstairs had closed early, but there were lights up in the Saint's windows, and Doc didn't have to knock but two or three times before Shasta opened the door and even smiled at him before saying, "Hi, come on in." She was bare-legged in some kind of Mexican shirt, pale purple with some orange embroidery on it, and had her hair wrapped in a towel, smelling like she did just out of the shower. He knew there was a reason he'd fallen in love with her back then. He kept forgetting it. But now that he half remembered, he had to grab himself mentally by the head and execute a quick brain shake before he could trust himself to say anything. Shasta introduced him to her dog, Mildred, and took some time rattling around in the kitchen. Flip had covered most of one living room wall with an enlarged photo of a gigantic monster wave at Makaha last winter, with a tiny but instantly recognizable Greg Knoll, cradled in it like a faithful worshiper in the fist of God. Shasta came in with a six-pack of Coors from the fridge.
"You know, Mickey's back," she said.
"Some rumor, yeah."
"Oh, he's back home, all right. Yep. Back home with Sloan and the kids, and so what? C'est la vie."
"Que sera, sera."
"You got it."
"Have you seen him?"
"How likely is that? These days, I'm only an embarrassment."
"Sure. But maybe if you did something about your hair,
fucker.
She reached, undid the towel, and threw it at him, shook her hair out. He didn't want to say violently exactly, but there was a look in her eye he remembered, or thought he did.
How's this?
He angled his head, as if she'd asked a serious question. Darker than it was.
Back to my old dirty blonde ways. Mickey liked it almost platinum. Used to spring for this colorist down on Rodeo Drive.
And Doc knew beyond all doubt that she and Penny had met at that same hair salon, where at least one topic of discussion had been him. And sure enough,
words around that you have this thing about Manson chicks.
Thing, guess it depends what you... Are you sure you want to be doing that? She had unbuttoned her shirt, and now, looking him in the eye, began unhurriedly to stroke her nipples. Mildred, glancing up in momentary interest, then shaking her head slowly side to side, got off the couch and left the room.
Submissive, brainwashed, horny little teeners, Shasta continued, who do exactly what you want before you even know what that is. You don't even have to say a word out loud. They get it all by ESP. Your kind of chick, Doc. That's the lowdown on you.
Hey, you're the ones been stealing my magazines? She slid out of the shirt and down on her knees, and crawled slowly over to where Doc was sitting with an untouched can of beer and a hard-on, and kneeling, she carefully took off his huaraches and gave each bare foot a soft kiss.
Now, she whispered, what would Charlie do?
Probably not what Doc would do, which was find half a joint in his shirt pocket and light it up, which she did. You want some of this? She raised her face, and he held the joint to her lips while she inhaled. They smoked in silence till Doc had to put what was left in a little alligator clip he carried with him. Look, I'm sorry about Mickey, but...
Mickey.
She gave Doc a good long look. Mickey could have taught all you swinging beach bums a thing or two. He was just so powerful. Sometimes he could almost make you feel invisible. Fast, brutal, not what you'd call a considerate lover. An animal, actually. But Sloan adored that about him. And Luce, you could tell. We all did. It's so nice to be made to feel invisible that way sometimes.
Yeah, and guys love to hear shit like this.
He'd bring me to lunch in Beverly Hills, one big hand all the way around my bare arm, staring me blind down out of those bright streets into some space where it was dark and cool, and you couldn't smell any food, only alcohol. They'd all be drinking, tables full of them, in a room that could have been any size, and they all knew Mickey there. They wanted, some of them, to be Mickey. He might as well have been bringing me in on a leash. He kept me in these little micro-mini dresses, never allowed me to wear anything underneath, just offering me to whoever wanted to stare, or grab. Or sometimes he'd fix me up with his friends, and I'd have to do whatever they wanted.
Why are you telling me this?
Oh, I'm sorry, Doc. Are you getting upset? Do you want me to stop?
By now she was draped across his lap, her hands beneath her, playing with her pussy, her ass irresistibly presented, her intentions even to Doc clear enough.
If my girlfriend had run away to be the bought-and-sold whore of some scumbag developer, I'd just be so angry I don't know what I'd do. Well, no, I'm even lying about that. I know what I'd do. If I had the faithless little bitch over my lap like this, which was about as far as she got, Doc managed to get in no more than a half dozen sincere smacks before her busy hands had them both coming all over the place. You fucker, she cried. Not Doc guessed at him. You bastard. He only remembered later to look for telltale zombie symptoms in case, wherever she'd been, they processed her somehow, the way they'd done to Mickey. But it seemed like the same old Shasta. Of course, she still could have made a deal to escape Mickey's fate
In which case, who was it with? And what was the payback? Before we could ask about any of that,